Vasishta, the sage, Vivekananda, W. Wang Yang Ming, War, Whistler, Women, World as Thought, World Crisis, Words, Why Yoga and Yogis, Youth, Zen, Japanese Mysticism, with Dr. Brunton's compliments, The Hidden Teaching Beyond Yoga, Some Misconceptions Cleared Up, issued as an explanatory supplement to the book, which is published by Ryder and Company at S. This supplement will be supplied free to all who have purchased the book and make application for a copy to Ryder & Co., Prince's Gate, London, S.W.J. Because of its apparently abrupt divergence from the line formerly taken by me, the recent publication of my new book bearing the above title has aroused so much comment, controversy and criticism among those familiar with my earlier works that I owe it as a duty to these numerous persons, no less than to myself, to proffer this note of explanation. And when such an explanation involves touching upon principles of vital importance to every seeker after truth, its value, even to those who neither know nor care for my work, destroys the last lingering hesitations which may have kept me from descending into a disturbed and disturbing atmosphere. First of all, let it be frankly stated that the book contains certain defects and some obscurities which of themselves have undoubtedly contributed to the creation of this position. One day, when the difficult circumstances under which most of it was written come to be revealed, the feat of writing, despite them, such a highly philosophical work at all may well be wondered at. For it was written amid the scrappy intervals and stolen leisure of a time-pressed life, harassed by wartime duties and uncertainties and beset by the varied handicaps and sudden illnesses of existence in the heat-filled tropics. But perhaps the main cause of these obscurities lay elsewhere. For 3 years a large international group of students had waited impatiently for this promised volume, and the echoes of their impatience constantly reached my ears. The need of assisting them towards a correct attitude regarding the war was also urgent and imperative. Finally, I decided that they could not be asked to wait longer, and rather than let them do so, I would release for publication what was so far available, however imperfect and incomplete it be, and defer its completion to a second volume. Thus the hidden teaching was presented to the extent of only an elementary fragment of its full content. I have to put up with the fact that this new book is so different in character and tone from those which have preceded it that the general reader is going to have a difficult time should he plunge into it with the light-heartedness with which he may have plunged into the others. Its pages made hard writing for me and must make harder reading for others. It needs sustained and concentrated attention, demands keen thinking, and propounds tough problems. For it offers a pabulum which is difficult to digest, being occupied with metaphysical matters rather than with mystic experiences. It is indeed intended more for the select discerning few who have made the supplement, Pole Star of Truth, their main guide amid the trials of conflicting doctrine and the temptations of natural prejudice. Very few have ever mastered this higher doctrine by their own unaided efforts. Whether known to history or not, a competent personal teacher has usually been present in the background of nearly everyone who has learnt it. The difficulties of finding one's own way through such metaphysical subtleties from beginning to end are not less than the difficulties of finding one's way on a black moonless night through a dense forest. The doctrine is so abstruse and so unfamiliar that the minds of most students necessarily bristle with thorny queries and questions. Continued enlightenment of their understanding and continuous elucidation of their perplexities is inevitably required. It is unfortunate, therefore, that a serious consequence of presenting such knotty material in such an unfinished form is that grave misconceptions concerning the teaching itself easily arise. It avails me little to point out that first sight delivers quick judgment, whereas second sight reserves it. The misconceptions have already arisen, and must be removed. It was only when the manuscript was being printed off, that is when it was too late for me to alter it sufficiently, as was then thousands of miles away in India, that I had the leisure to go through my copy of it. I then perceived how easily certain passages might create these wrong impressions. First and foremost is the notion that because I have revealed the limitations of yoga and mysticism, the two terms may roughly be equated for our purposes, as ordinarily known, because I have asserted that they do not yield the ultimate experience possible to man, therefore they are vain pursuits and illusory activities, and consequently the strong advocacy of meditation made in my former books falls to the ground. Such a misapprehension is queer and fantastic, for the very contrary is the case. I consider the practice of meditation to be as essential for everybody as ever it was, and I also consider it one of the most useful and most profitable pursuits a man can engage in. And it will be seen when the second volume of this book comes to be completed and published that certain meditation techniques comprise part of its most valuable content. But because these techniques are impersonal in spirit and universal in outlook, because they seek to provide ultimate realization rather than personal satisfaction, and because they are separated in time from ordinary mysticism by the metaphysical discipline, largely provided through the studies of the first volume, I have been compelled to call them ultra-mystic and philosophic and thus avoid confusion with the better known but inferior ones. If, therefore, I ventured to criticize the latter, it was only to prepare the way for the coming revelation of these almost unknown but superior techniques. This must not be mistaken to mean that the earlier work in yoga is in vain. On the contrary, it is of the greatest value, for the higher level cannot be attained if this preparatory stage has not been passed through. To imagine that I was disowning mystical experience altogether is utterly to misconceive my purpose. In spite of the seemingly conflicting tendencies of my earlier writing, the basic doctrines which were there affirmed still remain tenable, even though their stretch is now seen to be not far enough. For precisely the same reason, I deliberately emphasized the insupplement, sufficiencies of ordinary mysticism, the defects of ordinary yogis and the mistakes commonly made by meditators. It was to guard students against possible extravagances that I warned them that their work was not done with the reception of either exaltation or message, vision or voice. Who among them has not fallen into the self-admiring error of imagining that the first ecstatic exaltation is a direct communion with God or of taking the last oracular message from within as being the last word from God? Who has not heard of those who have degenerated into deluded visionaries or have fallen into exaggerated egoism or become foolish sentimentalists or set up a cult to exploit others financially? These are real dangers which surround the yogi, the occultist and the mystic, and which claim their victims throughout the world. And they arise because the student does not adequately understand what really happens to him during his mystic reverie, yogic trance, clairvoyant vision or ecstatic absorption. The seeker begins with faith, yes, but he must end with knowledge. God requires not only his vague belief from afar but his actual perception from close by. Only when his thoughts are made precise, clear and factual, when his feelings are given an almost clairvoyant self-understanding, and when his experiences are able to fall with complete comprehension into their proper place, can he hope to escape the aforementioned dangers. We can grasp this point better by taking the simple analogy of a child and an old man traveling on a transcontinental journey. There, one will pass through the same varied changes of environment, vehicle and experience involved as the other. Nevertheless, where the old man will thoroughly appreciate the meaning and worth of each change, the child will have only a more or less vague idea of it. Where the child enters a bank and is given money for the journey, all the chain of transactions that lies behind the simple act will be entirely unknown to it, whereas the old man will be fully cognizant of them. In consequence of this ignorance, the child may tear up and throw away a four-figure check merely because it believes the check to be a useless piece of paper, whereas it may hug strongly a bag of copper coins merely because the latter's heaviness seems to indicate greater worth. Similarly, the mystic may have remarkable experiences or exalted meditations, but may not understand accurately what is happening to him. He may, as we so often find in the history of mysticism, mistake the unimportant, unessential and accidental items for the important, essential and basal. For instance, the clairvoyant visions, occult experiences or oracular intuitive messages which may come to him may be taken as being more important than the sense of worldly materiality and of inner peace which he may experience along with them. He will thus be liable to minimize what should be magnified and to magnify what should be minimized. Moreover, unless he can tell with certainty the precise origin of each vision, voice, message or experience, he is always liable to make egregious mistakes. Finally, he is also likely to exaggerate the importance of his own ego because it has been fortunate enough to receive these wonderful experiences, and thus he will strengthen the very barrier which stands in his way to the highest goal. For he will one day find that he has exhausted his exaltation, that the dread experience of the supplement, dark night of the soul, of utter spiritual dryness, has descended grimly upon him. He could not understand before that when he permitted his ecstatic experiences to please him unduly and to flatter his ego unhealthily, they were weakening him. He may now discover that it is not enough to be as innocent as a child, it is also necessary for him to be as wise as a serpent. For the universal existence of which he is but a part must be understood, and the faculties of thought which are needed to understand it must be developed accordingly. Hence when King Milinda asked the Buddhist sage Nagasena why children could not attain nirvana, the reply was that a child cannot with a mind so limited comprehend that which is vast and endless. The mystic who imagines that he has attained to the over-self has really attained the edge but not the center of its flame. For if he has not undergone a certain kind of discipline belonging to the ultimate path, his effort will be a premature leap, and he will be unable to remain in the ecstatic state which he fondly believes has been permanently attained. Indeed, the very forces which he has evoked will sooner or later hurl him back, and this reaction will bring him that terrible and melancholy experience which nearly all advanced mystics have known. St. John of the Cross called it the dark night of the soul. St. Teresa called it the great dereliction ; the medieval Indian mystics like Dadu called it the phase of separation. Suso, the medieval European Christian saint, tells how he suffered for 10 years from a sense of sheer abandonment by God. The author of The Cloud of Unknowing tells of that terrible period when the mystic mayest neither seconds him clearly by the light of understanding nor feel him in the sweetness of love. The Persian Sufi mystics describe eloquently the agony of separation, and modern Western students of mysticism like Underhill, Inge, De Sanctis and Barbanson describe it roughly as a period of spiritual lassitude, stagnation, barrenness and dryness following a period of intense mystical activity and ecstatic experience. But it is most important to note that the dark night is an experience which happens only to highly advanced mystics. For it is the automatic effort of nature to secure balance, it is a pointing finger directing the mystic who has finished his mystical path to take to and thus bring the world which he has disdained or neglected once again within his purview. Something is obviously needed to check the gross extravagances of mysticism, to chasten the gullible tendencies of its votary, and to teach him to separate what is essential in his experiences from what is accidental. And this he can find in the metaphysical discipline. He must have the courage coldly to dissect every inner experience, mercilessly using as his instrument a rapier-like sharpened intelligence. He must not take his intuitions for granted, but must take the trouble to verify them. He must have the patience to study the true metaphysical meaning and purpose of the universe as of the over-self, to explore the mystery of time, space, matter and mind, to probe into the constitution of the human ego and to lay bare the most secret workings of his thoughts, words and acts. With the knowledge thus gained, he can proceed to test the truth, gauge the value and regulate the course of his inner development. And as the latter passes through this purifying crucible of rational metaphysical examination, he will supplement, discover how easy it is to set up mere fictions in the firm belief that they are solid facts, and how hard to keep to the straight and narrow path which leads to the sublime over-self. Such a pioneer researcher as Blavatsky, whose name is so often invoked for support to mysticism, occultism and yoga, herself admitted in the guarded hints given on page of The Secret Doctrine, volume, Los Angeles facsimile edition, that philosophy alone could throw absolute and final light and that outside of metaphysics no occult philosophy, no esotericism is possible, although her monumental book does not itself deal with the universe from this ultimate standpoint. Metaphysical reasoning has here a twofold utility. It is needed not only to act as a corrective for mystic experience but also to point out the further course which meditation should take. And that course lies in the direction of attunement to the universal impersonal all. All this is a preamble to the explanation that the harmony with all being, the unity with the world, which the mystic certainly experiences, is felt but not understood, is temporary and not enduring, is indirect and not immediate, is tentative and not final. So long as the ego lives fruitfully within him, all such cessation of egoistic experience must necessarily be transitory. The ego can be mastered and the mystic experience, by dulling the egoistic feelings, affords a powerful, necessary and pregnant hint of this truth, but it remains only a hint so long as the reason cannot take up and irrefutably prove, unshakably know with sharp insight, what the emotion intermittently feels during meditation. Hence metaphysics must step in and be coupled with meditation. The I can finally be defeated in one way alone, and that is by traversing the ultimate path. This combines a twofold process, first, by studying and understanding its true nature, by reaching through repeated and sustained examination and analysis the comprehension of its ultimate character, second, by practicing the ultra-mystic contemplation exercises, which lift consciousness above the intellect and the ego altogether. The knowledge heard in this manner becomes a weapon wherewith ego can be conquered with surety. The adventure of the yoga of philosophic discernment must join the yogas of devotion and mental concentration. All are necessary if a true and enduring experience of the hidden unity of all existence is to be gotten. Let it be remembered that the critical points which I make do not come from an opponent of yoga but from one who daily and devotedly practices it. They represent the observations of a friend, and it is the friends who have the courage to tell us the truth about ourselves rather than flatterers who help us most. It is therefore a gross misunderstanding of my new book to say that it counsels the aspirant to end his yoga practice when it really counsels him to mend it. Meditation must not be dropped. Only the foolish will ever do so. For it is a move in the right direction. Only it must be deepened and widened. Such deepening and widening constitutes dot because we have passed into a loftier dimension of thought or experience. We should not in our enthusiasm for it commit the error of renouncing as worthless what has already been attained. Because we have won an ampler comprehension of things, we are not called upon to reject what is true and useful in its own if more limited place. I have made a case for the need of still supplement, higher attainment, and such a need can only be satisfied by the ultimate path. In this way, the first volume has broken the ground for seeds to be sown by the second, wherein the supreme metaphysical keystone plus the ultra-mystic meditation practices will be offered. The second misconception which requires to be corrected is the most dangerous of all. It prevails chiefly among European and American readers, for Asiatics grasp the point better. Despite the plain hints and open statements scattered throughout the first volume, they have misunderstood me to assert that the faculty of reason is sufficient of itself to attain the highest truth. This is a gross error and will certainly not receive any support from my pen. I have explained in the book the difference between intellect and reason, showing the superiority of the latter, but pointing out that it does not attain its fullest development unless it can be raised from the concrete level of science to function vigorously on the abstract level of metaphysics. I have stressed the need of verifying the findings of authority, intuition, intellect and mystic experience by reason, but I have not set up its final supremacy. Such an exalted position must be reserved for a grander faculty. Hence if I had given the impression that this ultimate path is purely an intellectual process, then I have not succeeded in communicating my ideas. It is initially rational, yes, but it is ultimately ultra-mystical. For metaphysics may fall beneath the wheels of as many errors and dangers as mysticism. Its greatest possible error is when it would abstract and set up a single part of man's being, the reason, as alone entitled to satisfaction. When it would thin down all experience to purely logical and rational experience, and when it would intellectualize all the fullness of existence into a dried-up formula. Life is more complex than that. For if the ordinary yogi is like a blind man who can move but cannot see clearly where he is going, The ordinary metaphysician is like a cripple who can see clearly enough but cannot move at all. Metaphysics, because of its intellectualist basis and rationalist bias and because of its disdain of the claims of feeling and experience as illegitimate, can only arrive at one-sided abstractions. For feeling and experience are integral parts of human existence, and a sound, adequate and true outlook must be comprehensive enough to stress their claims. We need a wider integration than that which metaphysics gives, because it passes everything through the sieve of the reason and therefore does not do justice to what is extra-rational. Its subtlest concept must be inadequate to interpret the real, that is the over-self. Metaphysics points to reality, but leaves it as an unattained possibility. It offers the conceptual pattern of truth but leaves it as an unexplored actuality. For metaphysics must in the end point beyond itself. It is but a stepping stone to ultra-mysticism. Reason can never give more than mediate knowledge. This is its inescapable imitation. It can only enter into the relational order of things, and is thus forever confined to the circle of relativity. Such is the dismal result of the reason's own unprejudicial inquiry, and yet a result of the highest consequence to truth lovers, however humiliating it be to those who would foolishly place reason on the highest pedestal, as clearly shown by Kant in the West and Shankara in the East. The true tells us of the real, informs us that it exists and makes its factuality known to us. But the true does supplement, not bring the real within our consciousness, does not turn its factuality into actuality, and does not enable us to feel it as a content of experience. For the real can neither be known by finite thinking nor communicated in finite thoughts. The over-self cannot be defined in positive conceptual terms. The failure to comprehend this, the insistence on squeezing it into rationalist forms, is to commit the intellectualist fallacy which lurks underneath every metaphysical claim to cognize ultimate truth. Metaphysics finds its fitting nemesis at the culmination of its own activity, when it must always lead to the explicit recognition of its inadequacy to absorb the real. Let it not set up its own limitations on a pedestal as though they were virtues, and worship them. The first service of reason thinking is to draw our attention to the fact that the over-self exists, but its final service is to perceive its own inability to reveal it. The immediate service is to tell us what that immaterial reality is and is not, but we may think of or about the over-self without actually knowing it. Such knowledge can only come outside thinking, which means that it can only come within some kind of mystical apprehension. Reason rises to its highest metaphysical level when, understanding its own restrictions, it eliminates itself, saying I, too, am but an instrument of being and not being itself. The concept of the over-self is thus only an intellectualization of reality, and can never be a substitute for the experience of the over-self. It indicates and anticipates this experience, but does not bestow it. What reason establishes as truth can be made real only by the ultra-mystic insight. One primary function of metaphysics is to discover what truth cannot be, and to correct the understanding of it. Thus it affords a precautionary check to the questing mind and prepares it to receive the ineffable illumination. If it attempts to grasp reality, it must then find how inadequate it is. At the point where it finishes, it must persuade the mind to have resort to ultra-mysticism. This is not the suppression of reason but the recognition of its limitation. It knows full well what it can and what it cannot do. For metaphysics develops that critical spirit of cold analytical appraisal which is essential to separate the false from the true, the illusory from the real. Such criticism cannot destroy what is true in mysticism, but only confirm it, whilst it preserves its practitioner from becoming the dupe of unworthy or incompetent teachers. It will now be seen how far away from the truth are those who have thought I have displaced mystic insight for mere reasoning. This article should clear up any further possibility of falling into such an error. If, therefore, my book praised the power of reason to adjudge the truth of ideas and to verify the experiences of authority, intuition and mystic visions, it was only to prepare the way for the work of the second volume, where the reader would be confronted by the grander doctrine of the over-self and where the reason would be forced to confess its own inadequacy. thus would merge the need of the superior faculty of insight, but this could be fully described only then. Moreover, I did not take the first volume farther than the doctrine of mentalism, and reason sufficed for that. However, reading through the written manuscript with a leisure which I did not possess in the slightest when writing it, I frankly confess that the last section of Supplement, Chapter 7, is likely to leave my readers in a state of confusion about my attitude towards reason. Because of my critical evaluation of what is called intuition, they will find it difficult to reconcile my strong emphasis upon reason with further remarks made in the same section, such as the method of reasoning upon all available facts raised by the utmost concentration to the high stature of immediate insight, is precautionary and preliminary to such a source which is insight and transcends reasoning. I have deliberately selected this sentence because it contains an obvious clerical error, one which I endeavored to get corrected on discovery, but was too late owing to the delays brought about by my being in India and by the book being printed in the West, and accentuated by the difficulties of wartime communication. The correct sentence is as follows: the method of reasoning upon all available facts raised by the utmost concentration to the highest stature, is precautionary and preliminary to such a source which is immediate insight and transcends reasoning. The mere fact that the sentence closes with the words "and transcends reasoning" should have sufficed to indicate to perspicuous readers that reason was not here regarded as being the ultimate faculty for finding truth. But confusions and doubts will arise because I did not attempt to describe this ultimate faculty of immediate insight, merely noting its existence, whereas I went at detailed length into the virtues of reason. The explanation of this course is that for the purposes of the first volume I had to stop with reason because the nature of insight and the ultramystic methods of its attainment properly belonged to the final exposition of the hidden teaching and were therefore reserved for the second volume. It would have been more helpful to readers had I added a few pages briefly explaining this difference between reason and insight, as well as between intuition and insight, and I greatly regret not having done so, and shall conclude this reparation by touching on the latter point now. Why have I refused to lend the name of intuition to this culminating process, although I admit that it is ultra-mystical? Why instead do I term it insight? The first answer is, as explained in my new book, that intuition is not always reliable, and must needs be checked by reason. The second answer is that intuition is not always at our command; it may be here today but gone tomorrow. But the most important answer is that intuition is something which comes to you, whereas insight is something which you have earned, which you have consequently made your own. Therefore, the sage can never lose his insight, whereas the mystic may lose his intuition at any time. The sage can always know the truth about existence because his insight is always there, whereas the mystic may sometimes feel the truth of existence and sometimes not. However, it will be easy to misunderstand my attitude towards intuition. I do not for a single moment deny the fact of its existence, and indeed could not do so without denying my own past experience and the present experience of many others. What is really meant is that the average person can never be certain whether a particular intuition which occurs to him at any moment is genuinely such or not. Such certitude can come only to the sage, that is, to the man who has comprehended and realized the ultimate truth about the universe. Such a man is the rarest supplement of creatures. I have therefore preferred to name his faculty insight, so as to differentiate it from this uncertainty which wraps itself around the ordinary man's intuition. The sage's insight enables him always to act with the assurance that he is right, and to think with the confidence that his conclusions are accurate. Moreover, it is not a fitful faculty but always at his command, whereas no ordinary man dare honestly claim that he can command intuition at will or that it is always reliable. Insight is infallible, and therefore it can be used to check reasoning, whereas the ordinary man must check his intuitions by reason. Intuition is blind; it may be accurate, but it does not know why what it feels is accurate. Insight, on the contrary, is the fruition of complete understanding and fullness of perception. A further difference between intuition and insight is this: the former extends to thoughts and things, whereas the latter is confined to knowledge of one object alone, the supreme reality, the over-self. Nobody can ever succeed in dragging insight down to the level of giving correct guidance to enable him to negotiate material circumstances, whatever they be, whereas anybody may get an intuition about the winning horse in a race, the true character of a human being or the worth of a doctrine. Insight shares with intuition the same qualities of spontaneous arisal, birth from within the self and unexpectedness, but after this it cannot bear comparison, for it works on a different and deeper level.